Blog Talk Radio.
All right, so thank you again, Professor Schiller, for joining me this morning. This is Friday, and today's date is September 27th, 2019. So exciting news about your new book, Narrative Economics. When is it coming out again?
Well, the official publication date is October 1, but I think you might find it already in some places.
Yeah, and definitely you can you can pre-order. So what is your ultimate goal of narrative economics, and how can a deeper dive into the data of stories help to separate cause from consequence? I mean, you do elucidate a lot of examples in the book of how maybe a frugality mindset might have exacerbated the Great Depression. So how can some of the research that you're doing help to really shed light on this and maybe even offer solutions that prevent economic events from being deeper or longer than they need to be?
Well, it seems that the economics profession has had some success in forecasting economic events. I think there has been a tendency to miss some of the most important factors, which are changes in people's thinking that they get from each other through a kind of contagion. The problem is, what drives all these business fluctuations? I think we have to look there for the causes of many fluctuations. The problem is that human conversation hasn't in the past and still isn't largely recorded or available for searching, but it's getting a lot better. So we can start to see what our people are thinking and how it's changing. And I think this will bring a revolution in economics.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the consequences after a major economic event is that, you know, some mindsets might become very contagious. As you noted, the frugality mindset after the Great Depression. Is there any sort of mindset going on right now that you're observing and you think should be talked about more than it might be?
Well, there are some that are obvious, and one of them is Donald J. Trump, and in other countries, other populists like him. Everyone's talking about it. I can't add to it in any significant way, except to say that it really has dominated our talk. Well, it's a small percentage in total, but it comes up with such regularity, and it's polarizing. But that's obvious. I think there are other narratives that are not thought of so much as narratives. And one of them is the artificial intelligence narrative, which would be stories about particular inventors or inventions who are inventing machines that will really replace human intellect. I think that's one that's lying in wait to affect our confidence. It's there. It's definitely there. But I can't claim that it's reduced our GDP yet.
Yeah. And we, you know, I just saw an ad for Superstore where one of the employees is screaming that robots are coming to take their jobs. So it reminded me of what you were talking about there, how that can be something that really, I guess it's like a deer in the headlights. It does stop. What does it do? Does it stop confidence, which stops consumption? Is that how it really affects GDP?
I think so, and that's how it happened in the past. In the Great Depression, there was a lot of talk of robots replacing jobs. Believe it or not, it's not part of our conventional history of the Great Depression.
Yeah.
The word robot was invented in 1920 in a play by Karel Čapek in Czechoslovakia, and that was it had in the Great Depression, when people saw unemployment going up, they blamed it on robots and a machine. Well, they didn't have robots that walked around and talked, but they had plenty of machines.
Absolutely.
And so they thought that was what was happening. And I think it could happen again because artificial intelligence is such a stunning development. And through things like driverless cars or pilotless ships, It looks like it's going to do something to our jobs.
Yeah, and drone strikes and all of that. Now, when we talk about what lessons we can learn from the Great Depression, I'm just wondering, like, in today's world, in the wake of the Great Recession, has credit returned more quickly to the consumer than perhaps it did during the Great Depression? I'm just wondering how much of this is also just access to money, because, you know, when you have people that suffer so great of losses, whether it's from stocks or from the housing market, we got both in the Great Recession, probably both in the Great Depression, I'm guessing. You know, was it just at this time we were able to get money back to the consumer more quickly? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, our credit markets have developed a lot since the Great Depression, and they're regulated better. They didn't, in the early years of the Great Depression, there was no Securities and Exchange Commission, or there was no Financial Stability Board, there was no Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So we learn, and things are better. But I think that we still are vulnerable to a consumption pullback, even though interest rates are low. People can afford to consume more because the cost of doing that is lower with low interest. Borrowing to do that is lower. But I think the narrative is it's not the only thing that affects the economy. I don't mean that. But it is an important thing. And it's right now consumption demand is holding up in the U.S. And that could change, though.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that, you know, credit card debt and consumer debt is higher than it's ever been. So a lot of the consumers, you know, businesses can borrow from extremely low rates, you know, through the bond market. But consumers, many of them are borrowing, especially for their small businesses. I hear this in all the conferences that I speak at. You know, they're really borrowing at credit card rates, which are exorbitant. I mean, they're usury rates, really, you know.
You don't hear that word usury so much these days.
No.
So there has been variations in people's willingness to borrow. It's not just due to the interest rate, the low interest rates. It's because of a kind of story about prudent living, a narrative again. And it's holding up now. People are, although the cost of borrowing is not so high because interest rates are relatively low now. If you don't do it on the credit, if you borrow against your house, for example.
Yeah. So this market, you know, I was talking to Lizanne Saunders a couple of weeks ago, and she was telling me, giving me data, saying that this bull market has been largely built on corporate buybacks. And that up until the 2016 election, she said that, you know, the bull market was the Rodney Dangerfield market, that it wasn't really getting any respect. Since then, and according to her research, she believes that, you know, the consumer confidence is higher and that skepticism might not be as pervasive. What are you seeing in, you know, your research of, you know, the stories being told about stocks and or the housing market?
Yeah, well, I don't always have the most current narrative. Stories being told about stocks. I think that one thing that's happening is there's a fading of the worry about crash. I actually do questionnaire surveys of individual investors, and I can tell you that I've been doing them for over, close to 30 years. The lowest ebb of support for safety in the market was right after the 2009. We're right at 2009. People thought, although the market had gone down, you know, something like 50% in real terms, they were thinking it would go down even further, a lot of them. They were talking about 1929 at an exorbitant level. So it was a narrative that came back. Now that narrative is fading. We still call that recession the Great Recession, which is a play on the word Great Depression.
Yeah.
It's still in our minds, but I think the recovery that we've seen since then is partly due to just forgetting about the stories we heard about people losing their houses and suffering under unemployment. They're not fresh in our memory anymore, and that helps explain. So it may be more of that than new narratives. It's also the Donald Trump narrative, which provides a script for a new way of living. More ostentatious. You may feel more embarrassed to be poor. Trump talks about losers. He's very harsh in his judgments of some people. And so I think that affects our thinking, that we have to keep up with the Joneses, as they used to say in the Great Depression. They used to say that pejoratively.
Yeah, and now you think that it's become almost a bad. I mean, McMansions are not coming back into style, but definitely people are categorizing themselves as winners and losers. That's for sure. The shift to nationalism is not just in the U.S. I mean, it's in a lot of it's a problem in a lot of the developed world. You noted that this was the case before World War II and Hitler, and part, you know, contributing to Hitler's rise.
Right.
So, what's at stake here?
Well, this is getting into politics. I am worried about, as are many people, about the polarization in our societies and the rise of primitive nationalism. To some extent, it's leaders imitating each other. I think a lot of people around the world are looking at Trump and being marveling at his success. And so it's a logical thing to do, to try it here in my country. And that is a scare. It's also, I keep emphasizing that part of my theory is about going viral, ideas going viral, but it's also just being forgotten. So I think another idea that, a narrative, powerful narrative that's being forgotten is World War II. That was such a nightmare. And for a long time afterwards, people were much kinder to each other and supportive of minority, not in all dimensions, but they were willing to support international comity. And that's fading. And so we're slipping back into our tribal past. And it's worrisome.
Well, even from an economic standpoint, you can talk about how nationalism, you know, maybe tariffs, trade wars, that sort of thing. What are the impacts traditionally of tariffs and trade wars? Because this gets lost. I mean, a lot of people are not even aware that, you know, American businesses and even largely American consumers are going to bear the brunt of these tariffs and trade wars. But in general, what do economists think of tariffs? Are they an effective tool to stoke economies, or is it the exact opposite?
Well, ever since Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776, economists have a visceral negative reaction to tariffs. They think it's just protecting less competent businesses. It happens because of bribery of one sort or another. On the other hand, we do have a problem of rising inequality, and it's not being addressed. Well, maybe a couple of our Democratic candidates seem to be addressing it, but it's a tough one to implement. It may be a better election strategy to focus on immigrants as a threat to our jobs, because we can think we can do that without. But even so, it's potentially damaging to the economy. And not only is it potentially damaging as a real cause, but it's also a narrative that we remember from the Great Depression. A lot of people during the Great Depression thought that the trade war created by the Smoot-Hawley tariff in 1930 was the cause of the Depression. So it's an old narrative that is recovering as people see it happen today, and it may have even worse impacts on our economy because of that.
Do economists think that act, the tariffs, it was right around the time of the Great Depression, right? It was right around then when it was passed, right around in, the 30s?
Right. Well, in the 1928 election, tariffs came up, and then it was in 1930. That was just months into the Great Depression that the Smoot-Hawley tariff was put on, and it didn't it didn't work. It didn't stimulate. Yeah. The country just sank into the worst depression ever experienced by 1933.
Yeah, so it could be, I mean, I'm sure that there have been many white papers written on it, so it could be a kind of a toxic cocktail of frugality plus the nationalism that actually exacerbated the Great Depression, or were there other contributing factors that we need to be looking at today as well?
Well, I think that one important factor in the Great Depression was that people were thinking more about confidence and others' confidence. It was it was a general trend over the early 20th century that people were reading more about psychology, and they thought that depression, well, it referred to a mental state, but it also referred to an economy. The first surveys to measure consumer confidence or business confidence occurred in the late 1930s by George Gallup. And now we have these confidence numbers talked about all the time. One thing that's changed is we have the stock market reported every day prominently as if that was a measure of confidence in the economy. Actually, it's a measure of confidence in something more narrow than the whole economy. But we've accustomed to thinking of that as a barometer of our national psyche.
Yeah. Now, the White House has been very vocal about zero interest rates. The Federal Reserve has, we've seen three dissents now with very wide-ranging view on where interest rates should be. Although, of course, the policy has been to cut it, and the market at least is expecting another cut in December. What are the potential problems with continuing this policy? Are you concerned about asset bubbles, financial instability? Negative interest rates haven't seemed to serve the rest of the world. Why would they serve us?
Yeah, well, it's a complicated decision. That's why there is dissent at the Federal Open Market Committee. And I think that part of the reason that it's ambiguous what to do is because it involves human psychology and human narratives. The idea of cutting interest rates all the way to zero as a dramatic stimulus measure, I'm more than a little uncomfortable with that, because it's like your doctor giving you a strong antidepressant for your mental condition. you think, after you hear that, you think, I must be really mentally ill if he gave me that. And so it harms your psyche. So I think I've called the zero interest rate the Z word, because once you say that and implement it, then people think, wow, we must need strong medicine now. And it reminds them of the famous narrative of the lost decade in Japan, which turned out to be lost decades after they cut interest rates to zero. It didn't work for them either. And so that's you stimulate.
Are you concerned about asset bubbles or financial instability? I mean, that's something that I've been seeing in the financial stability report, and especially what 50% of the corporate bonds are now just a hair's breadth above junk bond status. Ford was just downgraded couple weeks ago by Moody's. Are you concerned about this?
Yes, I am concerned, because there is a debt liquidity cycle and a leverage cycle. So we're seeing corporate balance sheets being more leveraged, and that has been a sign of I don't like to use leading indicators exclusively, but it has been a sign of approaching recession. And we could be there. There's also a question whether the recession will be how big and strong. We will have a recession eventually. I don't know about in 2020. But if the memories of the 2009 financial crisis, 2008-2009 crisis come back, that could harm confidence.
So you're saying that just the narrative itself could actually create a deeper recession than would otherwise need to be.
Well, that's the idea that I'm promoting in my book, Narrative Economics, that they actually are a causal element, that narratives are like diseases, whether good or bad, but it's
Yeah.
like influenza. Influenza lies relatively tame until suddenly there's a big epidemic, or maybe it's not so big. It depends on mutations in the influenza virus and maybe something like weather conditions. But I think the same thing is true with narratives. So, like I was saying, the artificial intelligence narrative doesn't seem to be scaring people, but it's there, and it could come back and do a big scare.
Right. And it's interesting because you said it also, like in the dot-com recession or previous to that, it was actually not a scare, but something that everybody wanted to profit from, right?
That's right. And then the dot-com thing came to an abrupt end. Around the time Barron's wrote that's an investor's magazine, wrote an
Yeah.
article called Burn Rate. It documented how many of these dot-com companies were close to insolvency. So it became a
Yeah.
sudden narrative that this is it. It also came after the new millennium. We had been hearing all these expansive stories about the future. And here we are now in the year 2000, and it's looking kind of iffy. Maybe we were suffering a hangover after our new millennium party.
Yeah, no kidding. It's interesting also what I, because you were talking a little bit about, how, the Donald Trump narrative is one of winners and losers and wanting to be richer. But the interesting thing here is that the sharing economy and micromobility and preferring bikes that are kind of hallmarks of the millennials and the Gen Z, is this at all a factor? Could this be signs of a new modesty craze that might start competing?
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, you mentioned bicycles, or you could also mention scooters that are starting to appear more. That
Yes.
happened before, during the Great Depression. A lot of stores set up bike racks outside in front of their store because there was a big switch to riding bikes. It happened then. It can happen again. Right now, it
Yeah.
isn't associated with poverty so much. But it could
No.
become associated with that. The bikes are relatively cheap.
Oh, interesting. So even though this move is coming about, it's not, it can still play into the Donald Trump, I'm winning narrative without it, it's not necessarily seen as frugality.
Yeah, that the problem with narratives is they're so subtle that you can't just focus on a word in the
Yeah.
narrative. You have to look at how it's. So it ultimately reflects humanity and the deep complexity of our minds and our emotions. So the idea is that some kind of new narrative just gets started,
Yeah.
and it goes like wildfire, and it can stimulate demand or it can contract demand. It's not something that we can view at this point from a purely mathematical viewpoint. We have to look at the content of the story and what is it that makes it so contagious.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is, as you were saying before, it is kind of difficult sometimes to separate cause from cause. From something that's actually causing it, or something that an economic event happens, such as people lose their jobs, and then they start worrying about the robots, and that becomes contagious. Or all of a sudden, you get like I do want your comments on the repo market, the overnight market. How does it go from 2 to 10% overnight, and then all of a sudden we hear about a rescue going on. What is really going on there? Is that a leading indicator of anything? Turmoil in the banking system that we need to be more cognizant of?
Well, I think monetary experts view that as far as I know, it is just a glitch that will be handled by the Federal Reserve. That
Mm-hmm.
the 10% interest rate was momentary, disappeared
Yeah.
quickly. But it could get magnified. The question is, how does a story receive by the public? And so, for example, in October 19, 1987, we had the biggest stock market one-day drop ever. It was over 22% on the Dow in one day.
Yeah.
So that could have led, and there was talk of the Great Depression then, but it just didn't register then. And so people thought it was just some technical glitch. And they went on, and there was no recession after that. But
yeah.
Another time it could be the story could take a different dimension. And this is what's hard to predict.
Do you think that perhaps, I mean, Ronald Reagan was really good at, slogans. Do you think there was some slogan that he managed to pull out that people just bought into?
A Reagan slogan. I'm thinking of Reagan jokes. He had some great jokes. I can use them. I've used them in front of audiences, and it still works.
Yeah.
The Reagan jokes were generally from the Soviet Union. So
yeah.
It was very effective. Soviet Union, which didn't allow free speech, did generate word of mouth humor that was very telling. And that's what I think of as Reagan is most famous for.
Well, do you want to tell one of his most famous jokes?
Yeah, okay. So a man just bought a new car in the Soviet Union. Okay, and the salesman is signing the final papers, and the salesman says, "Funny thing, I see that your car will be delivered on today's date exactly 10 years from now." And then the buyer of the car says, "Morning or afternoon?" And the salesman says, "Well, if it's 10 years from now, how can you care whether it's morning or afternoon?" And then the buyer says, "Well, the plumber is coming by in the morning."
Yeah, that's definitely something that would be effective. And apparently it's so effective it can tear down walls, right?
And so those big changes in the Soviet Union were narrative induced. You know, when I visited Moscow in 1989, I was struck at how people would talk against the government. I thought this was not allowed. And I didn't see it in newspapers. My tour guide, I had a tour guide that gave me a tour of the Kremlin. And she said, this is the official interest guide. She said, "I think civil war is coming in Russia."
Wow.
Said, what? So it seemed like I experienced glasnost, as they call it, freedom of speech. People were really doing it. And that was word of mouth. And it wasn't due to the internet. It wasn't. That was 1989. No internet. No,
right.
No newspapers reporting on this.
Yeah. But there might have been some sort of economic depression or something that preceded that mind shift.
We went into a department store, and they had nothing there. And there was long line. I asked somebody in line, "What are you standing in line for?" And he said, "Soap."
Oh no!
Some things weren't working right, and they sensed hypocrisy, and they wanted a change.
Yeah, there's an ancient Chinese saying that the emperor stays in power if the economy is good, and if the economy is not good, then there's a divine, how they used to replace them by divine authority, and the divine authority was so highly linked to how well the economy was doing. Probably works for elections too, right?
That's a good story. I didn't know that one.
Yeah, I studied Chinese philosophy in college. I mean, who knows? It was just a survey course, but something that struck me since I like economics.
This is it. You remember the jokes and the narratives easily. I don't mean just you.
Yeah, everybody does. Now, the housing market right now appears strong. Houses are higher than ever. Prices are higher than ever. There's still sales going on, but the unaffordability index is starting to look very problematic, particularly in the cities that have the strongest labor. Are you seeing any signs of a shift in the winds in the housing market, or do you see any potential problems that could start becoming warning signs, like unaffordability, I would assume is a leading indicator.
Yes, well, we have our own S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller home price indices.
Yeah.
And with our latest data, there seems to be still going up nationwide in most places, but other overall, it's going up at a much lower rate. It used to be in the double digits shortly after the bottom of the housing market in 2012, but now it's well, on a national index, it's about 3%, but it's much lower. And now that is a sign of weakness, and it's a sign that this market is different from the stock market. It has much more momentum to it. So if we're losing momentum, it could suggest that drop off, like we saw in 2006 before the financial crisis. But it's a slow thing. It's hard to predict where it will go from here. Home prices have gotten a lot higher than they were in 2012.
Yeah.
So you could easily imagine that we'd see a drop in home prices. But I hate to suggest that it'll be anything as dramatic as we saw 10 years ago.
Yeah.
That was the most dramatic drop in real home prices we've ever experienced. So.
Yeah. Well, there certainly are fewer liar's loans and extreme over leverage like there was then. It seems to be, at least. The research that I've seen.
Well, we have regulation that's discouraged over leverage. And also, people are more careful now. I think there is still a fear of debt, oppressive debt. It's an old narrative that goes way back to Thomas Jefferson, even before.
Wow. Well, let's talk a little bit about your CAPE ratio, because that's something I've been monitoring now for a couple of years, and it seems like it's been extremely high for a couple of years. Can you just talk to us about where the ratio currently stands and the risks and implications of that?
Yeah, well, the CAPE ratio is real price per share divided by 10-year average of real earnings. So it differs primarily from a price-earnings ratio in that we don't just use 1 year's earnings, we use a whole decade's earnings for the denominator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because earnings jump around a lot from year to year, and they can even be negative. And so it makes sense to average over a longer time period. So the CAPE ratio for the S&P 500 now is in the high 20s. It's between 28 and 29 or thereabouts.
Yeah.
And that is high by historical standards, since the historical average is something like 17. So we have a high, but it's not as high as it's always been. We had a price earnings ratio of 46 in the beginning of 2000. That's like more than 50% higher than it is now. So we could certainly keep on going up and not break any records. But it is a concern. I think that the expected return on the stock market isn't as good now. On the other hand, if you're thinking of pulling out of the stock market to go into the bond market, you have a problem, because the bond market has very low yields still. So it's not so clear what to do. I would say be careful about over investing in the U.S. market and consider investing around stock markets elsewhere in the world to diversify better. But there's no reason to panic at the present time that I see. We'll find out.
Yeah.
That's what Trump likes to say. We'll find out.
Do you have any last thoughts? And I thank you for your time. I know we're coming up on the 30-minute mark here. So do you have anything, any last thoughts on the economy today, and or narrative economics that you want to make sure that we consider?
Well, I just think that economics profession is changing with the times, and in particular the availability of data. So we have digitized text for all sorts of sources of human exchange, talk and conversation. And this will, but it will take decades for economics profession to sort this out. But we're in a position where with modern computers, which will be an essential element of the research, we ought to be able to classify and organize our thinking about narratives. Narratives repeat themselves in history, but they have to. You have to have them up to date. And there are so many narratives that it may require a computer to become complete. It's hard to summarize the effect of all of them, but I think we'll get there.
Yeah, and I mean, there are some big recurring narratives that you outline in your book, right?
That's right. And they can come back. They may sound dimly familiar, but there are enough people that remember them that they provide a background against which to take off again. And they may have a human interest component that that is very strong. Any narrative involving some people making a lot of money fast tends to be contagious. That's why we have bubbles. But there's other kinds of, there's also narratives that have a different emotion attached to them, not so much glory in making a lot of money, but it could, can also be anger at other people and the willingness to boycott something or some nation or some product. These are all narratives that can come back.
So both of those actually played into cryptocurrency, right? Both the people making a boatload of money quickly and also anger at the system?
That's right. It was sort of an anarchist sentiment. That, the anarchist narrative goes back to the early 19th century. Hatred of government, in a sense that if the government just didn't exist, we would be fine. One reason cryptocurrencies have been so popular is they seem to suggest a route toward a real lack, a real cutting off of government influence, that we cosmopolitans can run our own business quite well. Thank you. We don't need the government regulating us.
Yeah.
On top of that, we had this nice mystery story about Satoshi Nakamoto, who was the supposed inventor of Bitcoin. And you know what? Nobody can find him. Nobody knows who he was. Maybe he doesn't even exist. Maybe it was some committee somewhere that wrote that.
Yeah.
And that actually adds to the, it's a mystery story. People like mystery stories. And it reminds people, whenever someone comes forth claiming to be Satoshi Nakamoto, those are famous narratives, those like Anastasia or the Dauphine.
Yeah.
And Sarah. When someone is can't be found and imposters coming up, keep coming up. That's a great narrative.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for so much for your time and providing clarity on where we are today. So you're not seeing in you even said that perhaps 2020 is not a recessionary year, right? So you're not you're not seeing doom and gloom on the horizon here.
No, and there's also a question of how bad a recession it will be when it does come. A lot of recessions have been mild. Let's hope for the best.
All right, those are good words to end on. I hope that I hope that you are feeling well, and I'm sure your book's going to do great.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks so much.
All right, bye.
Goodbye now.